Sorry, say again. Okay. Yeah, hold on. Okay, great. Yep, no worries. My name is Brett Eldridge, and like I said, I'm here to talk to you about mobile IPsec vulnerabilities. Just before we get started, some of the goals I have for this talk. I want to educate people about the details of IPsec. I'm not here to present zero-day code. I want people to kind of understand what happens when you use a GUI and you put together an IPsec solution, what's going on underneath the surface. I think the advent of GUIs have made it much too easy for people to put together these systems and not fully realize what's happening at the protocol level. So, just a quick outline. I'm going to talk about what the problem we're trying to solve. Talk a little bit about IPsec, and in particular, Ike, and then go into details on phase one negotiation. Then I'm going to present a couple different solutions for solving this mobile VPN problem. Talk about the pros and cons of each of those solutions. And then I'm going to talk about an interesting concept that I've come up with called Ike Daemon Fingerprinting. So that's kind of the fun stuff at the end. The problem overview. What we're trying to do is provide access to internal network resources for mobile users in a secure manner, basically authentication and privacy over a public network. It's the so-called VPN. The mobile user will have a dynamic IP address on the internet. Many people solve this problem using IPsec with pre-shared keys without understanding potential weaknesses. This talk is based on a paper I wrote on how to configure OpenBSD laptops for mobile VPNs. So one question I have for people in the room is, how many people connect to their corporate network using IPsec? Go ahead and raise your hands. I'd say probably 30%. Now, how many of those people use pre-shared secrets? I think there's more of you. Maybe you don't know it. Or maybe you're afraid to tell me. So this is the de facto solution. Basically, deploy IPsec clients and use pre-shared keys for authentication. This solution has at least a couple implications that should be analyzed for potential information leaks. The first is using pre-shared keys with dynamic IP addresses requires Ike aggressive mode, which exposes IDs during the protocol exchange. So that's one weakness you should be aware of, and we'll go into depth during the presentation. The second is that IPsec initiators have dynamic addresses, right? If you're dialing in or getting connected via wireless or anywhere else on the internet, we can't predict what IP address you're going to have. It's going to change every time. So based upon that, the gateway that's running the Ike daemon needs to accept Ike connections from any IP address on the internet. This is kind of my ASCII art diagram of IPsec. I'm going to go into kind of each of these in detail on the next slides, but I just wanted to give an overview of kind of how IPsec is arranged. I don't know how many people in the room have read the RFCs for IPsec, but they're complicated, extremely complicated. And he wasn't kidding. And then the other thing he said, which turned out to be totally true, was after you read them, you'll come away with more questions than you had before. The RFCs overlap each other. Ike and ISACAMP are extremely similar, and it's confusing. And you have to read the RFCs in depth and then really think about it to understand what they mean. Bruce Schneier has a quote from his IPsec paper. It goes like this. Even though the protocol is a disappointment, our primary complaint is with its complexity. It is the best IP security protocol available at the moment, and I can pretty much predict that it won't change. There's too many vendors that have spent too much money on IPsec to put another protocol in place. So like I said, the area that's in yellow is we're going to concentrate most of our time talking about, but I will talk about the other areas as we go through it. So a quick overview of IPsec. There's two primary security protocols, authentication header, which provides data integrity and authentication, but no confidentiality. So if you want to authenticate the sender and make sure that the packet contents haven't changed in transport, AH can do that. Encapsulating Security Protocol, ESP, provides data integrity, authentication, and or confidentiality. The and or is kind of interesting. The RFC for IPsec basically says that you can have null encryption and authentication, or you can have null authentication and encryption, but both can't be null. Another one of the things Schneier says in his paper, and he argues, is that there's really no need for AH, given that ESP exists. You can get, you know, I don't know, 99% of the functionality of AH with ESP. So some terminology we need to use. SA is a security association. It's a triple consisting of an SPI, the destination IP, and the protocol type, either AH or ESP. So what is an SPI? SPI is a unique identifier or locator for a given SA. So we can identify which SA we should use for a particular connection. A nonce is a randomly generated value used to defeat playback attacks. These two last terms are kind of important. Everybody uses them in the IPsec community, initiator and responder. Initiator is the device that starts or initiates the IKE protocol negotiation. So in this case that we're trying to solve, it's obviously the laptop. You've got somebody with a laptop that dials in, and they're going to initiate an IKE connection to the gateway, which is at your corporate network. The gateway itself is called a responder. This is the device that receives the first IKE message. In this case, like I said, the gateway to the internal network. So keep those two terms in mind as we go through the presentation. Key management. The crux of the IPsec problem is key distribution and SA management. IPsec, the protocol, defines two broad classes of key management. Manual key management. So this is where you configure all IPsec parameters for a security association to occur. It requires n to the n minus 1 divided by 2 key exchanges for a fully meshed VPN. So just to give you an idea, let's say you have a VPN network that's fully meshed with 10 nodes. That will require 45 key exchanges. Using automatic key exchange protocols. So the, was there a question? Oh, no, that was a phone. No comment. So using automatic key exchange protocols, like I said, so if you don't use manual keys, you're going to use automatic key exchange. Some of the protocols are ISACAMP, IKE, SK, MEM, and a few others. Let's talk about manual key management first. You manually configure encryption keys, security parameter index, source address, dest address, etc. on both ends. It requires pre-negotiated keys for both encryption and authentication. This is usually done via voice or encrypted email. So the way people set up manual IPsec tunnels is that the admin at one site calls the admin at the other and says, hey, let's use this key for encryption and let's use this key for authentication, and they both configure their gateways. Sometimes they might take the key and encrypt it with PGP and send it over email. But the point being, there's no automated way to exchange keys. You have to manually do it. This doesn't scale because the keys are static, and adding a new node involves manually distributing keys to all the existing nodes. So once again, if you have a fully meshed VPN, and let's say you're at 10 nodes like we had before and you add an 11th node, it's going to require an additional 10 key distributions. And then if you add a 12th node, it requires 11 more. So the problem grows in complexity. Static keys also imply that if an attacker figures out one key, they own the whole VPN until the key is manually changed on all nodes. And like I said, so if you have 10 nodes, you're going to have to change the keys on 45, well, 10 different nodes, but 45 different parameters. It's not fun. This is why most people have moved away from manual keys. It used to be in the old days, if you wanted to get interop between, you know, two different firewalls, two different vendors, the only way to do it was manual keys because nobody agreed on how to do IKE. But most people have moved away from that now, and most IKE daemons do interoperate. So here's an example from OpenBSD. This is how you create a manual IPsec configuration. We'll go through it real quick so you get an idea of what's involved. So IPsec atom, that's just the command to add it. New, And we're going to use ESP. So remember, the two protocols are ESP and AH. In this case, ESP. We give it a random SPI number, 1000. The source address, 192.168.5.1. That's us. And then the destination, which is the remote side. And we're using Blowfish for encryption, SHA-1 for authentication. And then the first key is an encryption key, and the second key is an authentication key. So note, that just controls outbound traffic only. We now need to create another command for the inbound traffic. And you can see the only difference there between the two is that the source and dest are reversed. Okay, so given that we don't want to use manual keys, what other choices do we have? And this is where automatic key management protocols come in. They automate the creation of the SA, SPI values, and the encryption and authentication keys. Some example protocols are ISACAMP, which is the Internet Security Key Association and Key Management Protocol, Oakley, and Ike. So Ike is the Internet Key Exchange. It's basically a conglomeration of pieces of ISACAMP, Oakley, and SKEEM. Quote, Ike is the default key exchange protocol for ISACAMP, and at the moment, the only one. And basically, Ike is built on top of ISACAMP. And this is where the RFCs get confusing. If you read the RFC for ISACAMP, and then you read the RFC for Ike, they're very similar. So let's talk a little bit about Ike itself. ISACAMP implementations must support UDP port 500. Now, it's interesting that I'm talking about Ike, and yet I say ISACAMP. And this is where the confusion comes in. Basically, Ike is the transport protocol for ISACAMP. So ISACAMP implementations must support UDP port 500 and may support other transport protocols over IP itself. I don't know of anybody's implementation that supports anything other than UDP 500. If somebody does know of another one that supports TCP or some other protocol, I'd be interested to hear it. But the RFC does allow for it. And the use of UDP is actually interesting in itself. When you think about it, we're talking about key exchange and key management, and why they picked UDP, I'm not sure. You would usually want a reliable transport protocol for key exchange. The RFC basically says that because UDP is not reliable, we've built in reliability into the ISACAMP protocol itself. I don't know that I agree with that method. Anyway, two phases are involved in the Ike key exchange protocol. Phase one, so this is where two peers basically exchange keys and create an encrypted channel. Phase two is where the actual IPsec keys get exchanged. This is an interesting quote. Ike phase one requires that, quote, a large enough portion of the data must be sent in the clear simply to bootstrap the negotiation. So we've got a security protocol in which we're sending information in the clear. Let's dig into phase one just a little bit. Phase one has three types of authentication. So we've got two peers that need to authenticate each other before we can start sending keys. The first is pre-shared keys, and this is probably the most widely deployed method. Most people use this method because it's easy, and it's supported on most implementations. The next is digital signatures, and these are based on X509. People do support digital signatures. The one area I have seen complications is when you try to get vendors to interoperate with digital signatures. And then the last method is public key encryption. I know of only one implementation that supports public key encryption. There might be more, but the only one I know of that does support it is FreeSWAN. Basically, with public key encryption, you exchange public keys to all the nodes you want to communicate with. There are some significant advantages to using public key encryption, and I'll kind of touch on those in a little bit. So inside of phase one, like I said, Ike is complicated and IPsec is complicated. Now we're digging down into phase one modes. So we've got phase one authentication, which are three methods, and then we've got phase one modes, and there's two of them, aggressive versus main mode. So I've done kind of a comparison between the two here. Main mode uses six messages, while aggressive mode uses three. Therefore, aggressive mode is going to be faster. in aggressive mode due to the fewer key exchanges, or sorry, fewer message exchanges, fewer attributes can be negotiated during the exchange. An example of that is Diffie-Hellman parameters. So if you want to pick a Diffie-Hellman group, so mod P768 or mod P1024, you have to pre-agree on those if you're going to use aggressive mode. You can't negotiate it during the protocol. The last point is the important one, and that's why it's in bold. Main mode protects user identities by not sending them until they are encrypted. It's also called ID prot mode for that reason. It basically protects both the responder and the initiator identification because they get sent later in the message exchange. And the corollary to that, obviously, is that aggressive mode does expose user IDs, and we'll see an example of that in just a minute. So back to the problem. If the initiator, so in this case the mobile laptop, has a dynamic IP address, you only have a few choices for authentication and modes. This is another quote from the RFC. When using pre-shared key authentication with main mode, the key can only be identified by the IP address of the peer. And I have a diagram which shows the messages so we can see that. The implication of this is that the initiator and the responder must both have static IP addresses if you want to use main mode. So basically, if you want to protect the ID of the initiator and the responder using main mode, and you want to use pre-shared keys, the only way you can do that is if both sides have a static IP address. So why can't you use main mode with pre-shared keys with dynamic IP addresses? Basically, this is what it comes down to. This is straight from the RFC. And you can see for the, remember, the goal in main mode is to protect the ID. So you can see at the bottom where the asterisk is, that means that it's, the payload is encrypted. So in this case, the IDs are encrypted. But the only way we can identify the initiator from the responder is by its IP address. There's nothing sent in that first message that identifies who it is. So we can't look in our configuration and figure out which parameters we should use for that person. This kind of sums up where we're at this point. Along the left, we've got the three different authentication methods, and along the top, we've got the two different modes. Given that most implementations don't support public keys, we can't use that. So assuming that we have to use either pre-shared keys or X509 certificates, what are our choices if we have to support mobile users? They're basically aggressive mode with a static or dynamic IP address, and in this case the ID is exposed. The only other choice we have is to use main mode with X509 certificates, in which case the ID is protected. And like I said, I can guarantee that most people are probably using pre-shared secrets in aggressive mode because that's just the easiest thing to set up. Aggressive mode with pre-shared keys. Just kind of recap, many people use this solution because pre-shared keys are easy to configure. With aggressive mode, the user identity must be sent in the clear as part of the initiator's phase one initial message. And here's what it looks like from the RFC again. You can see in this case that the initiator, along with the SA and the header and all the other information, sends its ID, and that is sent in the clear. The responder can send its ID. It does not have to, because remember, the initiator already knows who the responder is because they've initiated the connection. Here's a TCP dump trace from an OpenBSD system. And you can see that we're using aggressive mode, so the top line there says aggressive at the end. And you can see what happens. In the payload, you send, in this case, your user fully qualified domain name. So I've sent my ID in the clear, and anybody that's on the network can see it. That has quite a few implications when you think about it. What are those implications? One is traffic analysis. So what if you're using IPsec in a government-oppressed country? So I want to protect my traffic, and I don't want anybody to know who I am. In this case, you're automatically sending your ID in the clear. have you sent your ID here at DEF CON, and is anybody collecting them? I sat next to a guy yesterday at a table who said, yep, the wireless isn't working too well, but I was able to get an IPsec connection to my corporate network and run Outlook. And remember, it might not be a user fully qualified domain name, basically an email address. He might be sending his NT domain login name as the ID. You can set up anything you want. So you just have to realize what you're doing when you set up these systems. So potential risks if you are passing ID and using legacy authentication. A lot of vendors are starting to implement what's called XAuth. So XAuth is the ability to query a remote authentication system to use authentication. So if you use XAuth with Radius, you can send your Radius ID and authenticate against that instead of a local database on the gateway. This is another interesting one. Correlate an individual with a specific IP address. Since the mobile user is now outside the corporate firewall, so I'm sniffing the network, and I see somebody send an Ike ID of bill@microsoft.com. I could be pretty sure I now know Bill Gates' IP address and where he's coming from, which makes an interesting attack. Remember, the way Microsoft got broken into a while back was that somebody broke into a Microsoft employee's home network and then tunneled back into Microsoft. So the bottom line of this, and this is kind of why I started, was it's important to realize what you are exposing in a given situation and assess those risks for your organization. It might be that this is not a problem in your situation, but the least you should do is analyze it and figure it out and think about it. So given that we don't want to use aggressive mode, and we want to protect identities, what choices do we have? Here's one choice, and I mentioned it before. Use certificates with main mode. What are the problems with using this? Well, there's high deployment cost, so you have to create a CA infrastructure. Each user has to create a public-private key pair. The end user then creates a certificate signing request, sends it off to the CA. The CA signs it, sends it back to the user, and then the user installs it on their laptop. And you can automate a lot of it, but there's still a lot of infrastructure you need to put in place. And then, on top of it, you have to manage a certificate revocation list as well. And then you come to the question of, should you protect the certificate with the passphrase? And obviously, I mean, the answer is yes. You don't want to have somebody with a certificate that's unprotected on a laptop. It doesn't do much good in that case. I'm not sure how many implementations support, certificates that cache passphrases. The problem you can run into is if you protect your certificate with a passphrase and you start a process to use Ike communication, you have to give that passphrase. And then if the key times out, you have to type in the passphrase again unless the application caches it, and I'm not sure how many do. When I did set this up with OpenBSD, it does not cache your passphrase. So if you use a certificate on the laptop to connect to a gateway, and you start the EZCAMPD process, it will ask for a passphrase. And then once the keys time out, it will ask for it again. Here's an example, another TCP dump trace of a session getting initiated. And you can see now, instead of aggressive mode, it's ID prot mode, or it's main mode, basically, another word for it. The authentication method is RSA SIG. And you can see that there's no payload sent with my user ID. Okay. Remember I said there's two basic problems, or two basic potential weaknesses when you put an implementation in place. One of them was this idea that IDs get exposed. The other one is that you need to allow connections from just about every IP address on the internet to your Ike daemon on the gateway, on the responder side. And I don't think a lot of people have thought about what that means. So these are some thoughts for some future research. You can basically probe a remote gateway that has an Ike daemon to determine the system details. So two prime examples of what you can find out are vendor ID and then the encryption and authentication algorithm supported. And I have some examples of both of those. If you read the RFC gives the ability to implement what's called the vendor ID payload. And the interesting part is that it says the vendor ID defined constant must be unique. The recommended usage is to hash a string at the vendor name plus the version. So in other words, you can hash, you know, Checkpoint Technologies, Firewall 1, 4.0, SP3, and then take an MD5 or SHA hash of that and send it. And basically, it's so that vendors can interoperate and set up their own, I guess, additional capabilities with Ike. So it provides the capability to determine not only the vendor, but also the exact version of code running. So what we need to do is develop a table of hashes versus vendor IDs. So wouldn't it be nice if you could connect to somebody's Ike daemon, get back an MD5 hash, and say, wow, that's Cisco IOS 1202T. And the other thing is most vendors don't alarm on failed negotiations in some log. So this is potentially a great way to fingerprint a system similar to Nmap. Here's an example of a vendor ID payload being sent. Once again, a TCP dump trace from OpenBSD. You can see that in this case, actually two vendor payloads get sent. If we kind of blow those up and look inside the packet, you can look at the same packet that has a hex dump. So I've got the two strings. Once again, remember, two vendor ID strings were sent. In the first string, you can see the first 160 bits is an SHA-1 hash, presumably a vendor name plus version. The second string is really interesting. You can actually convert the hex codes to ASCII, and it spells out heartbeat notify. So in this case, I just happen to know what this is used for. It's basically used to make sure that an Ike tunnel is up and working, so a heartbeat gets sent. And the reason we use vendor IDs is that you can know that the other side supports this capability. But think about the implications now. Like I said, we can figure out what type of box your firewall gateway is, and you don't even know it. And it's important to understand how your vendor logs and alarms on failed Ike negotiations. How many people have ever looked in their VPN gateway at Ike negotiation logs in detail and said, wow, I've had 10 failed negotiations in the past minute? Another interesting concept is the idea that you can probe the remote gateway and find out what encryption and authentication algorithms are supported. So in some cases, people support DES, or they might even support null encryption. And basically, the concept is send an Ike message 1 to the responder and try different algorithms, or what they call transforms. So the first transform I might try is SHA-1 authentication and null encryption, and see what response I get back. If I get back that it continues to negotiate, then I know it's supported. If I get back a failed negotiation, then I know it's not. So we can map out every single protocol that you're supporting on your gateway. So given all this, what are some recommendations? One, if possible, limit Ike connections to specific IP addresses or ranges. And I don't think a lot of people do this, and they should. So let's take the case where you've actually got static IP addresses. Let's say you've got two corporate branch offices, and you're using main mode, and you've got static addresses. Why should you allow negotiations from any IP address on the internet? And have you even tested it? Have you tried to connect? You should know what you're doing when you set these systems up. So given that you must support mobile users in most cases, what can you do? The first step is use main mode with certificates if possible. Remember, this will protect the user IDs because they get sent after the encryption keys have been set up.
The second is use a single dial-up provider and limit connections to their IP address range. So, I mean, in reality, it's not practical, right? You're not going to get a single carrier with a single IP network that you can limit IP negotiations from. This one's really important. Understand IKE log messages of your specific implementation. So if you're running Firewall One or you're running Cisco or anything else, understand what that box does when you get a failed IKE negotiation. Does it log it? Does it alarm it? Does it give details? How far did it get? If your vendors don't log failed IKE negotiations, bug them. And I think that's it. Hold on. Oh, just a page of references. So once again, you know, the only way you can learn IPsec is read the RFCs and actually implement it and test it before you put it out in the real world. So I'm done a little early. Does anybody have any questions? Oh, yep, sorry. Yep.
I still see why people have problems getting basic things like IP authentication set up from vendor to vendor. And I haven't seen too many sites except, say, with the exception of Howard and you, where people actively describe, okay, if you're trying to go from this server to this server,
how do you do it?
Have you seen any other repositories like that?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question. So the question, in case you didn't hear, is how do you set up VPN tunnels between different vendors' boxes. So if I've got iOS on one side and Firewall One on the other, how do I set that up? There is a site, I believe it's vpnc.org, the vpnconsortium.org, that has some information. Part of the reason for that problem, honestly, is that the RFCs are so unclear as to how you should build and implement IKE and ISACAMP and all the other protocols that vendors, and they didn't want to wait for them to get completed, so vendors just started implementing. I will say that I've seen it get better. If you take a modern version of most firewall gateways, they will talk to each other with IKE with pre-shared keys. Anything else? Yeah?
Can you say anything about the metaversa and the security information?
No, it's a good question. So the question was, can I say anything about NAT traversal and the security implications of using it? So basically, if you don't know, for the most part, IKE does not work behind a NAT device. But there is, I guess, I think it's a draft at this point of something called NAT traversal, and it's a way for IKE to work. I haven't studied it, honestly, but it's another area. This is another area where people should look at what's going on at a protocol level and say, am I revealing something? You know, am I putting out IP addresses that I shouldn't? Or am I giving information that I don't want to? Good question, though. Yeah?
How about the IPsec between two dynamic IPs?
As far as I know, I'm not going to say definitively, but I don't know how to do it. I don't know if it is possible. Yep. Oh, sorry. The question was, what about IPsec between two dynamic IP address devices? You could set it up on the fly, but you'd have to change it each time. Is basically what I think it would come down to. Yeah.
You'd have to set it up so that you have some type of DNS or WINs to track those IP addresses. Otherwise, you don't know where to send that packet.
Yeah, but think about the security implications of doing that. So I've got two dynamic IP addresses, and now I'm trusting DNS to identify each other. Yeah, I mean, you are using IKE authentication in addition to that, but it's just, you know, I probably wouldn't trust it.
You can set it up in radius for some vendors. You have to actually have the SA set up on the dynamic IP addresses.
On both sides?
Oh, that's true. Never mind.
It gets tricky, right? Anything else? Yep, sorry.
How would the addition of some sort of strong authentication, secure ID, to the set of connection affect the level of security of using
the It's an interesting question. The question was, what would the use of something like crypto card or secure ID, what he called strong authentication, affect the security? I think you still, so let's assume you're using secure ID and XAuth on the back end. So basically somebody sends a token value. I believe you're still going to need to provide a user ID in Ike in addition to the token value. So you're still exposing your user ID. I mean, granted, it's a one-time secret, so it is going to be better from a secret standpoint, but I think you still need to expose ID because you need to correlate ID with token. Yes. Yep. Anything else? Yeah. I don't think I mentioned man in the middle attacks, did I? Oh. So the question was, can I elaborate on man in the middle attacks in phase one, right? It's an interesting question. Remember, by default right now, Ike vendors support UDP for Ike negotiations, and UDP is notoriously weak, especially... Oops, I think my battery's dying. Anyway, UDP is notoriously weak, and you can probably pretty easily spoof an Ike negotiation message given that it is using UDP. So this is kind of one of the things that I alluded to in the beginning. The RFC doesn't it mandates that you support UDP 500, but it also allows for other protocols to be used for transport for Ike. So you could use TCP, theoretically, or you could use another protocol on top of IP itself. But like I said, I don't know any vendor that supports it. And I don't like the idea of using UDP for key exchange. Yeah, over here. Sure. So the question was, I talked about phase one. Can I talk about phase two and any security implications of that? So remember, phase one is used basically to set up an encrypted and authenticated tunnel. So if you look, I don't have them on my laptop right now, but if you look at, let's say, the six messages in phase one, the first two, everything is sent in the clear, and then information starts to get encrypted. So once we have an encrypted tunnel, that's when you start phase two, or quick mode, and actually start negotiating keys. So at that point, the only information somebody has from the outside is the IP address of both peers. So the primary problems are in the beginning during phase one. Does that answer it? Okay. Anything else? So the question was, why isn't public key authentication widely deployed? And it's a good question. So let me go back to one slide that I had, and basically it showed that table of basically authentication that you can have given a given mode. The way public key works is I take somebody's public key and install it on my gateway and vice versa. So basically when they send me an encrypted nonce, I can go through keys and try decrypting it and identify the remote party without having them send an ID. So what that means is if you do support public key authentication on both the mobile side and the gateway side, you can use aggressive mode and still protect ID. The problem is most vendors don't support it. And the question is, why not? I can only think of one reason. There's probably others, but in my mind there's only one reason, and that is the key distribution problem. So let's say we have 10 nodes. We need to, everybody, and you want fully meshed. In that case, everybody needs to create public and private key pairs, and I need to install all other 9 people's public keys on my gateway. And then when you add a node, you have to install that other extra public key on all the existing gateways. So I don't know, but my guess is that vendors looked at it and said, and then there's the trust problem. Like, how do I know it's your public key? Because it's not signed by a trusted authority. So then you have to get out-of-band hashes of the key to verify that it's not been trojaned or man-in-the-middle attack. So I think, and like I said, I don't know, but I think vendors looked at it and said, this is going to be hard to maintain and users aren't going to want to do it. So they didn't implement it. But it is a shame. It should be an option. I mean, it would be great if more vendors did support it. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. So the question was, in this case, where I'm trying to solve the problem of a mobile user to a corporate gateway, you don't really have the fully meshed problem. And you're absolutely right. You don't. You only need to install the user's public key on the gateway. So for every new user, you need to install their public key. So it's less of a management problem than the fully messed situation. And like I said, I mean, I would love it if vendors supported it, because it just gives you another method to build a security system. Yeah. Yeah, so that's another point. And his kind of statement was, it can get worse if you have, let's say, 1,000 or 5,000 mobile users, because not only do you have to put their public key on the gateway, you have to put the gateway's public key on their device, right? Because you have to be able to authenticate each other. Anything else? Yeah. With mobile IP addresses, probably not a lot. It's probably more relevant if you have static IP addresses. And then you might need fully meshed. Anything else?
Do you know which vendors do support public key?
Like I said, as far as I know, the only one I know of is FreeSWAN. I know that I'm pretty sure OpenBSD is a camp. TD doesn't. I'm pretty sure Checkpoint doesn't. iOS might, and I know NetScreen doesn't. Yeah.
I was going to say that now
which gateways support that, though?
Their own.
Oh, their own. So, yeah, the statement was PGP, I guess NAI, supports PGP keys for authentication, but you need to run basically the PGP client and the PGP gateway to use that. Yeah, and NAI dropped PGP, so.
Checkpoint supports
public key? Okay. Oh, it's new. Great. Was that supported in 4 or... is it only an NG? Yeah. It was in 4, okay. I haven't used a checkpoint box in quite a few years. Yeah.
Who was it, Ontario or TCP show that you used to decode the packet trace?
Oh, the question was, what tool did I use to show the packet trace? I was using TCP dump on OpenBSD. So I believe if you give it a -VV or -VVV, it will show packet contents. TCPdump.org will do the same thing. You just need to give it a couple V flags for it to show the packet contents. Anything else? Yeah.
Are you aware of anyone with poly lists of hashes associated with
VendorID? The question was, do I know of anybody compiling a table of vendor ID hashes versus implementations? Yeah, and is that information going to be public? I will say that I know people working on code to remotely probe masses of Ike gateways. And the real question is, it's a disbursement problem. How many different hashes are there going to be? Because remember, hashes by nature are unique. So if you change one small parameter, it's going to change it. So what we need people to do is basically say, I probed a Cisco IOS box running 12.2T, and here was the hash, and need to compile it, kind of similar to the way Nmap does it. I honestly don't know if anybody has compiled an exhaustive list or even close to it at this point, but I think after today it will start to happen. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so it's a good point, and I'll kind of talk about a couple things about it. The point was, if you have a good Ike implementation, you shouldn't care what information you're exposing. Is that kind of a summary?
The vendor and version should not need to be secret.
Yeah, the vendor and version should not need to be secret, so not necessarily Ike ID, but the vendor version number. So I guess a couple things along that line. Remember, you're just trying to figure out what type of box it is. So it's not only Ike that you can attack on that system. The goal is to figure out what type of system it is to maybe figure out what else you can use. So I'd put it into information gathering is the way I would put it. And yeah, if you do have a secure Ike daemon, you really shouldn't worry about it. The question is, how many people have audited the Ike daemon code? Right? Remember in the beginning I mentioned Ike itself is an extremely, extremely difficult protocol to get right. If you read Schneier's paper, which I recommend everybody does, there's multiple ways that you can basically screw it up if you aren't careful about it. But yeah, theoretically, if your Ike daemon is secure, you shouldn't care that you expose vendor IDs. But that's theory. Anything else? Okay, great. Thanks for coming, and enjoy the day.